Hello and welcome to the Racing Post Front Page, the show that looks back on all the key topics and all the hot talking points in the sport of racing. We have got so much to get through in a week where it's been busier off the track than on it. So we'll start by introducing my guests. To the left of me is Catherine McRae, fresh from seeing Shishkin's brilliant win in the Ascot Chase. Catherine, how much did you enjoy that?
It was brilliant, yeah. It was a real sense of atmosphere there on Saturday and a brilliant performance, a great training masterclass by Nicky Henderson, who seemed thrilled to see the brilliant, what was a 2 mile chaser, now back to his best up and trip.
Yeah, and Chris Cook in the corner, you weren't on Shishkin, so possibly didn't enjoy it as much as I did, to be fair.
Well,
although I'm giving that away. Fantastic story, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, you need these star horses to perform. And he certainly was that. It was very disconcerting, the way he sort of disappeared into the doldrums for about 10 months. But, you know, he finished out his race over that new trip on Saturday so convincingly. You know, he's a hot favourite for the Ryanair and arguably deserves to be hotter.
Thank you very much, Chris. And you're right, the Cheltenham Festival is only 3 weeks away, so there's no better time to become a Racing Post Members Club member. So we're going to go on to our first story of the week, and we're going to come to you, Catherine, first with what's been happening with the whip.
Yes, so the whip rules are definitely not a new issue, but developed this week as the rules were introduced for jump jockeys on last Monday. And on Friday, we finally heard from BHA's chief executive, Julie Harrington, who spoke at the Asian Racing Conference, and afterwards to Front Page regular Lee Mottershead, who's out in Australia. And she illuminated some of the reasoning the BHA made behind the decision, most specifically to try and bring in new fans of the sport, citing some research done by the Great British Racing that some of the people against the sport, one of the biggest issues is that it's perceived as cruel and that these rule changes might try and ease that barrier. And specifically looking at younger people who found that a bigger issue than the general overall statistic. I think it was 45% of 18 to 24-year-olds who are opposed to racing found it a cruel sport, in their opinion, and that changing these rules on a big showcase event like the Cheltenham Festival might be the key to trying to negate some of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's an interesting sort of topic now because the whip is obviously had such change. It's been tweaked since the sort of first consultation. The results of that came out. We've, of course, had the backhand position, which was in place. The jockeys have been furious about that and it's suddenly gone. But the idea that the whip needs to be sort of changed for the younger generation is something of a little bit of a sort of revelation from this week's news, of course. And the stats that show that 18 to 24-year-old bracket being so sort of aware of it is something that's quite concerning. I mean, we'll come to you, Chris. You've written quite a lot about the whip. In terms of how important the whip is to that sort of younger audience, where does it sort of stand? Is that the key issue? What are the sort of, you know, what can racing do, I suppose, to keep to attract to them? Is the whip the problem?
It may be part of the problem. I mean, the number one thing to me is I find it just completely bizarre that we're informing our policy by reference to what a bunch of young people who are not affiliated with racing in any way and are never likely to be think. I mean, it seemed to me a total non sequitur in what Julie Harrington was saying. She said that, you know, those people see racing as cruel, the ones who basically pay no attention to horse racing. And therefore, we've got to do something about the whip because that will improve how they see the sport. But the bit in between is, well, is it the whip that makes them think that it's cruel or is it other things? Because I tend to think that if you're talking about people who have no engagement with racing whatsoever, you could take the whip away completely and they would still find enough in there to make them think, oh, it's cruel. I mean, they've not engaged with the sport in any depth. That's not a judgment that's informed by any particular length of study. These might be people who think that anything involving animals, where you're sort of making animals do a sort of proper day's work, would count as cruel. So why on earth we're sort of putting ourselves through this extraordinary upheaval and giving ourselves months and months of rotten headlines and ruining our reputation, you know, amongst our own fans and also, you know, the sort of among sports fans who might be paying any attention whatsoever. It's just completely baffling to me. It seems self-harming. And I don't really remember this being in part of the discussion last summer when the new rules were drafted and put out there. So I find it very worrying. I feel like we should have been hearing more from Julie Harrington, you know, over the last 6-7 months and even before that, just to sort of to explain why we're doing this in a bit more depth. I mean, I can't believe that what she's quoted as saying in Australia is the full extent of her thoughts on the matter. You know, you'd like to give her enough credit to think that there must be more there. But what she has put out there is profoundly unconvincing and frankly upsetting given what we're going through. The WHIP issue is still really worrying. We're about to get, we think this week, the first bans from last week, which was when the new rules came into force. And that's the time when we'll find out, you know, how damaging this is going to be, how many people are going to be affected, what sort of length of time these jockeys are going to be off for. And we've got this sort of quirk that I don't think many people have really got to grips with yet, that because it's all being done by a centralised WHIP review committee, all the bans that are imposed from a particular week will start on the same day. So if you think back to the first week of the betting in period when they said something like, I think 29 jockeys were found in breach of the shoulder height rule. Mm. So that's minimum 4 days. That's 29 guys who are going to get a 4-day ban that will all serve at exactly the same time. I mean, that's a significant portion of the Jumps weighing room just gone like that. And you think about the impact that, you know, rules like that could have when we get to high summer. You know, there are already some Saturdays when it's hard to find the jockey or a kind of jockey that you want for your horse.
And you sort know, of weights and how horses are weighted and
yeah, and well, just so many meetings around the country, yeah. You know. If you're missing a sort of significant proportion of the weighing room, you know, on top of all the usual problems, then, you know, trainers and owners could be having a very hard time indeed. And of course, the jockeys themselves trying to earn a living. So I think we're sort of facing up to a really difficult period, and I'm afraid the conversation is not over on how these rules should look in their final form. And to think that we're going through all of that and undermining the appeal of the sport to the people who've been following it for 20, 30 years, just in an effort to impress a bunch of people who are almost certainly not going to be impressed, it's kind of heartbreaking.
Yeah, go on, Catherine.
I was going to say, Harrington said that she was as confident as she could be that the WHIP issue wouldn't be a factor come the Cheltenham Festival. I don't know if you think that's going to be the case.
Well, I think there are certain elements to what she said where I thought, well, okay, well clearly there is the facts and there's the data that suggests, okay, well, people are uncomfortable with a WHIP, so maybe we do need to address it. I mean, for me, the way we've sort of, the situation we've gone now is it's not the forehand or backhand position, it's the amount of times it's used. I mean, is that going to be enough for people to say, well, I wasn't comfortable with it, but I am now? I think that's very vague. And there were a couple of things in that where I just thought, this just doesn't quite add up to me. So there was a comment in there, she says that the sport would look better in the Gold Cup finish on national news because of the fact the WHIP is used less. Well, actually, 18 to 24-year-olds, how many of them watch the national news? How many of them are sat at home watching news? Because that is an element of how our consumers and that potential audience will interact with the sport. It'll be through TikTok, it'll be through social media. In fact, Ofcom said that only 53% of 18 to 24-year-olds use the sort of national news as their main use. So the idea that we should be...
Right. That's very old thinking, isn't it?
It's old thinking.
What goes on the news at 10 is what matters to everyone.
But one of the key issues is that we know that social media is unregulated, and it's also sensationalised. It's unregulated, sensationalised. So if someone has an agenda that says horse racing is cruel or horse racing is wrong, uh-huh. a really hard fall at Cheltenham Festival, nobody wants to see it. But that can be clipped and shared, and so that propaganda can be delivered. So in my opinion, it's not about changing our rules around. It's being able to create not so much a defence, but some sort of a place where racing can say, you know what, these things do happen. It's part of the sport. It's part of jump racing. this is what we've got and this is what makes our sport good. Really sell and promote the sport. And I think we probably all have seen Richard Hawes' comment on ITV's programme. We should be proud of our sport. We have to be proud of our sport, otherwise it won't exist. If we're not proud of it, no one else will be. So to just sort of on that sort of theme,
yeah,
what is that sort of messaging? What does that messaging have to be like according to you? Because that's my opinion. What's yours, Chris?
Well, there's got to be an element of leadership here, hasn't there? And someone said to me last week, you know, racing feels like it's in danger of worrying itself out of existence. You know, and he was talking not just about the whip rule problems, but, you know, all the other issues that we keep on talking about and never solving. To me, the fact that we're in that situation where we're always talking about negative stories, that's a failure of leadership. And I was trying to think about, you know, who were the last people that led horse racing that sort of made you feel kind of good about yourself, that made you feel like you were in the right place and this was a terrific sport and you wanted to be part of it? I mean, you probably have to go back to Paul Bithar. You remember when he was chief executive at BHA? I don't know exactly off the top of my head how far back that was. I mean, the thick end of 10 years anyway. I'm afraid, you know, Julie Harrington is just not dynamic or you know, available enough to be that kind of leader. And we do need somebody, you know, and we need several people, I think, at the top of the sport who can sort of have that kind of charisma and magnetism to sort of draw people in and, you know, make not just us the journalists, but, you know, the sports, you know, followers and punters and spectators, make them feel that they're really part of something worthwhile and fun and, you know, and righteous. I don't think that's going too far. But I'm afraid, you know, the sport has not been radiating anything like that for years and years. You know, we've just, you know, we're struggling in the mire at the moment, and, you know, we need someone to lead us out of it.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think possibly it's fair here just to give a bit of sort of positive news. We have discussed the Invades group in the past, and I've sort of been in touch with them a little bit, and they talk about how, so this is the group of essentially they bring students to the race course. They brought over 5,000 students to Cheltenham, which made up a quarter of the race day experience. And the thing with them, because I discussed with them when the Jockey Club released about their fashion and what they can wear, the dress code is the word I'm looking for. And they said the biggest barrier for people coming racing is the cost. And actually, there was a survey done, which I found, Survey of Horse Racing Opinions and Perceptions, published in January 2022. And this is where there is some evidence which suggests that Gen Z are very sort of put off by racing because of the whip use and horse welfare and ethics. But the biggest barrier there at 77.3% is cost. So perhaps we are a little bit dangerous of just using the whip as the main issue when actually there's others. So there's a whole factor of things that
do you know, I wrote a piece about this, you know, complaining about why are we doing this blooming whip review right now. I mean, it's obviously a bit late to be saying it now, but you think about the quantity of headspace that's taken up, not just for us, but for the sports leaders. You know, I would think around New Year time, when they knew and we didn't yet, that they were about to abandon the forehand ban, you know, that would have been the only thing they were thinking about. And it's just terrible to have put ourselves in that situation when there are so many other real problems that we have to get to grips with. You know, we should never even have reopened this can of worms. People should have remembered what it was like the last time we went through the whip rules in 2011, what a nightmare that turned out to be. And in hindsight, we were kind of lucky that there were a couple of senior executives who turned out to have a good working relationship and were able to hammer out some kind of compromise from 2012 that worked. And it was, I'm afraid it was a great mistake to sort of, you know, 7 or 8 years later start talking about we need to do something else about the whip rules. Because I don't think with the full benefit of hindsight, the problems we were looking at that stage were so great as to justify what we've been through since.
Yeah, and just finally from you, Catherine, as your story you sort of brought in, you know, it's going to be a bit of concern going into Cheltenham, isn't it? It's going to be one of possibly the talking points, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so, despite Harrington's hopes. I think another thing to note from what she said was that it's not a welfare issue, she believes, it's a perception issue. So,
and Peter Scudamore said the same thing as well on Friday.
Absolutely. Well. But, you know, the BHA saying this and they cited the RSPCA also agree with this shows they believe that the whip is fine in the sport, and yet there's a sense we're slightly ashamed of that as well. And it's what Chris was saying about the need for some kind of decisive leadership and willing to take a stand on what they believe in. And I do believe this will come up during the festival, especially as you've got Irish jockeys coming over who haven't had the bend-in period I'm sure we'll see a lot of fallout from that.
I mean, what's interesting is that if there are jockeys at the festival who break the rule, you won't find out for sure about it until at least the following Tuesday. So I'm sure that's deliberate, and that's a part of the new regime that might actually work. You know, if the only thing you care about is not having negative headlines on the day of the Gold Cup, say, yeah. Well, you might get away with that, you know, but there is going to be a little cottage industry on social media, I think, you know, where people are going to be going, oh, has he gone over the rule? Was that stroke above shoulder height there?
And it's a waiting game, and we're going to start hearing about jockeys that could potentially be banned for the festival.
Yeah, well, exactly that. And yeah, you've got to feel sorry for those guys, because realistically, we're still at a very experimental stage with these rules.
Yeah, I think the only thing we could be absolutely certain of is that we're going to be discussing that in a few more shows to come.
Happy days. More work for journalists.
More fun for us. Before we come on to our item two, we've got a very exciting offer for our listeners and our viewers watching at home, that if you check out racingpost.com/freebets, we've got over £200 of free bets which you can take advantage of. So do make sure to check that out. That's racingpost.com/freebets. Okay, Chris. We're going to come to you, and some jockeys in and some jockeys, unfortunately, out.
Big time names. We've got Ashin Murphy back. And then the very next day, we lost Tom Scudamore. So it's like a zero-sum game last week in terms of high-profile jockeys. It's good to have a guy as talented as Ashin back. I think even now, he's still only 27 years old. He is starting to feel like he's been around a long time, because he was so young when he started to make the headlines. Remember, he had that four-timer on Air Gold Cup Day. Absolutely ages ago. No question that he deserved his 14-month ban. I mean, he doesn't quarrel with that now. He says he's sort of taken the time to think about it, and, you know, he readily acknowledges that he made lots of mistakes, and he's going to be trying very hard not to do so in the future. So he says, I mean, of course, when a sportsman comes back in these situations, you know, they're so well advised in PR terms these days that they tend to say the right thing, and I think he has. As far as I can tell, you know, there's genuine remorse there. But much more importantly, from the hard-nosed perspective of your average punter, there's still a ton of ability there too. I mean, his very first ride back, he was on the right horse, but he's delivered a really good ride at Chelmsford. No sign of rustiness whatsoever. He's gone over to Qatar and won a very valuable, I think, a local Grade 3 race over
there.
That's
right, yeah.
And he's back tonight with something like six rides at Newcastle. Six rides at Newcastle on a Monday night. I mean, that's determination right there.
That's what you come back for, isn't it, Chris?
Well, yeah, exactly. How could you stay away when you can be riding there? So I see that the odds for the jockey's title race this year very much favour William Buick. I think he's twos on, won it last year very convincingly. 7-4, Ashin Murphy. Quite tempted to take some of that, if it wasn't in the back of your mind that there's got to be better or other 7-4 shots between now and October when you get paid, assuming you're right. But I mean, that's too big, isn't it, theoretically?
If you had
you know, all the money in the world to spend on betting, that's got to be a value bet, right?
Definitely, because he's won three of them for a start, and also the year he did win it, he actually beat William Buick, so you're head-to-head form, so to speak. But the situation is very, very different. We'll start on him before we, of course, go back to Tom Scudamore.
He
was obviously back after that 14-month suspension, won on Jupiter Express at Chelmsford on Thursday. He said he's feeling good. He said he's sort of back to himself. He's focused. There's been a little bit, obviously, one of the things with Ashin is he's been such a big character, you know, he's very forward. I remember one of the days he got real attention was when he went to Newmarket. I think he was beaten on three rides. And he gave a video explaining what happened, and that was quite a significant moment. It was in lockdown. He sort of talked through
what
happened.
Right.
And I think the public have really warmed to him. It takes a lot for the public to warm to jockeys, but with him it's different. So he's a popular figure. You know, you've obviously sort of dealt with Ashin. You know how well he's done. Do you think that big character is still going to come out? Do you think he might change? And similarly, do you agree with Chris that he's sort of still going to be that top tier jockey that we've seen in the last few years?
I think the start he's made proves that he's ready, and he's back in business with a bang. And I think his ability to connect with the public is a big factor in why people come to support him. I know our colleague Pete Scargill was at Chelmsford when he won his first winner back, and the sense of atmosphere there for a low-key meeting was clear. His friends and family were there. There was a lot of public support for him, and probably the most press there's been at Chelmsford on a Thursday evening. So there's definitely a lot of support there for him, and a lot of well-wishers hoping that you know, he can continue his incredible success he's had in the past, and all signs point to him doing just that.
I mean, he's so well spoken, isn't he? He's a really good communicator, and like voluntarily off his own bat, as you say, he's sort of done little videos in the past, you know, that have gone out on social media explaining how it went on particular rides that he's had that day. You'd love to see more of that. It's like he's using the authority that he's built up from being a champion jockey to speak a bit more freely than you're really used to with big-time flat jockeys. I think especially flat racing, more than jump racing, it's quite a tightly wound game because there's so much money involved when you're dealing with potential stallions particularly. A lot of jockeys have basically taken the view that, you know, I'm not going to say anything. And, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, he went way past that. And it was like he was reaching over the heads of journalists to talk straight to the public, which we should probably be getting a bit cross about. But I mean, that's how it's going to be for the sports stars of the future. And he was good at it. And, you know, I'd like to see him getting back to that. Because he gave an interview to the Times last week before his comeback where I think he was asked, what's the best bit of advice you've ever been given? And the answer was, a closed mouth catches no flies, which you hear a lot in racing. You know, there's always that sort of background atmosphere in racing, you know, shut up, don't say anything, don't tell no one nothing. It was a real pity to see him mention that. But I guess you understand it in the circumstances of, you know, him making a comeback where he feels a bit sort of bruised and battered by what he's been through and the names he's been called. And he's maybe wondering what his welcome's going to be like. But hopefully he'll get over that.
I think with that, Chris, you've also got to remember he's come back from a period of time and he wants to build those relationships back up. So his way of thinking is, this is my focus, this is what I want to do. That for a trainer who's thinking of using him, that's probably what you want to hear, if anything.
Well, maybe he's just playing to the gallery.
Maybe. Sorry, Catherine.
To tie it back into kind of what can we do to attract new people, having personalities like that in the sport who are able to communicate, who attract public attention, is so vital. We need these figures, these characters in the sport.
Yeah, and a figure who certainly we won't see on the race course is Tom Scudamore, the end of the Scudamore dynasty.
We won't see him in the back of a horse, but I mean, I'm sure he's still going to be around the races. You know?
Yeah, he certainly will, and his brother's still on the race cars at least, so we still will see Scudamore, just maybe not in a rides capacity. An incredible career, Chris.
Now, on the riding front, I mean, again, it's a bit too soon to be writing off the Scudamores as jockeys collectively, because Tom has a couple of daughters, and one of them, the oldest one, Margot, I've checked today. I gather she's still very keen on the idea of a riding career. Okay. She's got to get her GCSEs out of the way first. You know, we support proper education, kids stay in school. But once she's done that, she's apparently looking to get her amateur's license, and, you know, the sky's the limit, you know, judging on what previous Scudamores have achieved. So good luck to her. And good luck to Tom. I mean, he's, again, a really good speaker. And I'm sure he'll have a career in the media. I mean, he's already had that sort of choral ambassador's role that's been going for a good few years. And he's done plenty of TV work over the weekend, including with you on one of our shows on Friday.
Yeah, he was very good. The first to interview him, Racing Post should say.
Is that right? There you go.
Other than Catherine, of course.
Wow.
And, there we go. So we all know him really well because I did a book with him some years ago, which was about the whole Scudamore family. Tom's great fun. I mean, the words just pour out of him. And he doesn't have a sort of boring thing to say. It's all sort of new, interesting insights into the game. And one thing I took away from my time with him was how much it meant to him to have won a couple of races over the Grand National fences. Because, of course, his granddad was Michael Scudamore, who rode Oxford to win the Grand National one back in the 50s. And he actually set a record for the number of consecutive Grand Nationals that he rode in, which stood until I think it was, I mean, it may have been AP that beat it. It was only about 10 years ago that somebody finally broke that record. Peter Scudamore, obviously champion jockey 8 times, but never won over the national fences. So when Tom did it on Pool Master in the Grand Sefton, I think 2016, he was the first Scudamore to win over those fences for about 50 years. And it was only 4 or 5 months after Michael had died. So I mean, it just meant a huge amount. Because he'd grown up listening to his granddad telling him stories about riding around Aintree and the different ways that you could tackle it and what was the best way to go. And he said when he was riding Poolmaster in the Grand Sefton that day, he was actually hearing his granddad in his head telling him what to do, how to ride from the last fence to the elbow, and the importance of hugging the rail once you're past the elbow. And he said Sam Whaley Cohen was coming after him that day. And if he'd just rolled off the rail even a little bit, you know, that other horse would have gone up the inside and won. And he said that actually led to his second win over the fences in the Beecher Chase on Vieux and Rouge, it was. Someone else rolled off the rail in front of him and he sort of nipped up and won. So, I mean, you can't really talk about any Scudamore riding career without talking about the whole history of the sport, because they're just embedded. You know, they're like, you could tell the history of that family, and it becomes the history of jump racing since the war. And so it's great to think that there will be more of them. And obviously, as you say, Michael's still training. Peter's training with Lucinda Russell up in Scotland, and Tom's still going to be around. So, yeah. You know, they're a wonderful, high-achieving family. And everyone loves them.
Yeah, and love the game, really, aren't they? They're just the epitome. Fizzlecracked in Ast, he's won the Coral Gold Cup or the old Hennessy three times. Western Warhorse, we were discussing that ride.
Right. What Pat a Cooney mad
was saying he should erect. They were considering erecting a statue of him because he saved them so much money.
They could easily afford the bronze, I would think. Yeah, bet 365 by themselves.
Catherine, your highlights from a fantastic career?
I found it funny when I phoned him up when the news broke that the first thing he said to me was that he thought he was going to try and slip the news in quietly. I don't think there was any way of that happening because he has had such a big impact on the sport. One win that he highlighted and his father, Peter Scudamore, when I spoke to him was the Grand Annual success that he rode for his brother Michael on Next Sensation, I believe, and the, as you were saying, Chris, the kind of family legacy in that race as well. It's clear how important that connection for his grandfather, his father, him and his brother to all be entwined in the history of the sport and in a race like the Grand Annual. It's definitely a highlight.
Yeah, I mean, actually, Tom said in the book that was the race that meant most of all to him. He was crying buckets afterwards.
Really?
And so you would, you know, you're riding some outsider for your brother, you know, in a race like that.
Yeah. I think the final comment just on him, of course, he had a fantastic relationship with David Pipe, over 700 winners. David Pipe said on Luck and Sunday yesterday he's going to take some time to work out whether he will work out who will be his next stable jockey. He said he wants one. That's some role to fill, isn't it, Chris?
Yeah, a lot of horses there, and you never quite know when, you know, there might be a really good one coming out of there. David, he seems to be sort of spreading his love around this season. You know, there's a few good jockeys that he's given chances to, you know. So we'll see if somebody emerges. But, I mean, there's so much luck involved in that kind of thing. I mean, Tom got the job on Thistlecrack because Aidan Coleman chose to ride something for Emma Lavelle in the Grade 1 Novice Hurdle entry that time. And so, you know, Tom got the call up, and it just happened to be that was the day when he turned out to be Thistlecrack. And because you're on him that day, then you keep the ride and you get to win the King George and the Stairs Hurdle. So, you know, someone will probably be in the right place at the right time, and then maybe their career will take off.
Yeah, it's a funny game like that, isn't it? So that goes on to item three, my story. And this is a funny game, unfortunately. It's the story of affordability checks. So we are still every bit in the dark about the gambling white paper. Just to bring you up to date, if you haven't seen the show, if you haven't been aware of this story, so the government are about to release a long-awaited white paper into affordability checks. This is essentially saying, in order to place a bet, you'll need to provide sort of intrusive financial documents like payslips and bank statements. And unfortunately, the bookmakers have already started to implement these changes. They haven't been told directly that they need to do them, but they've been guided in a certain way that they need to do so. We've had hundreds of letters here in the Racing Post from people saying they've been asked to do things. Many people have walked away. They've said, we don't want to bet. Some have even admitted they've headed to the black market, which is a completely different and concerning issue. The key issue from a racing perspective is, of course, is it's going to take a huge hit on the racing finances. And of course, if it is implemented, that sort of woe is could be up to 100 million, was the figure stated weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, the gambling minister, Paul Scully, said it was not the Gambling Commission nor the government's responsibility to say who should be telling you how to spend your money and how much you can afford. Unfortunately, he's no longer in that role. He's been reshuffled, and we now wait for a sixth gambling minister since that review was announced in 2020. So what more do we know? So this week, Racing TV, the racing channel, has encouraged their punters and their fans of the sport to write to their local MP to tell them their own situation and to really sort of stamp down as how big an issue this is, not just for racing, but for punters and how they're affected by it. And at the Asian Racing Conference, which we discussed earlier, Tom Chignall, a senior executive from Hong Kong, has talked about sort of how the black market there has evolved and given a warning to British Racing that it would be, the affordability checks would be an open goal for black market gambling. And do make sure you read Tom Kerr, Racing Post editor, his column this week. A really, really interesting line here about just summing up what this is sort of like. It's absurd and offensive that people attempting to deposit a few hundred pounds with a bookmaker next month for the Cheltenham Festival are going to be treated as though they're incapable of the most trivial of financial transactions without the nannying of oversight of a bookmaker's compliance officer. A huge issue. It's not going away. Where do we go from here? I suppose we'll start with you in the corner there, Chris. We just don't seem to be getting any with it. The Gambling Commission had said it sort of seemed as if we were getting, there was light at the end of a tunnel. Paul Scully's now gone.
What's going to happen next? Frustrating situation. I'm out of the forecast business as far as this subject goes. I mean, because it's been months that we've been told the white paper is coming any day now. That's what we need. We need governmental clarity. You know, we need them to publish that flaming thing and tell us what direction they want us to go on in the future. Absent that, you know, the situation is just chaos and not a very fruitful or productive chaos from the perspective of punters. Tom's right, of course. You know, the Cheltenham Festival, betting on the Cheltenham Festival is going to be affected. It's a time of the year when, you know, people, they don't want to bet just like a bit more than they normally would. You know, the turnover for some people goes through the roof. You know, judging only from my own experience, you know, I could tell you that. And, you know, that's perfectly normal. There's nothing unhealthy about that. This is the highlight of our year. You know, this is our Christmas. And there are people who, you know, save money from month to month so that they'll have funds to bet with at the Cheltenham Festival.
Just as they do at Christmas. You save up and you spend all that money at once.
Yeah. You know, but, you know, from the guidance that the Gambling Commission, you know, we believe, has been punting out, you know, one of the things you're supposed to look for is people who are suddenly betting more than they normally would. I understand that can be a red flag, you know, and bookmakers have certainly got to know their customers. They got to, you know, be aware of signs of risk. But at the same time, you know, surely they're allowed to take into account that here's the one of the biggest betting events anywhere in the world, any time of year. And hopefully people will not actually have problems when they come to deposit sums and, you know, and try and lump on one of the Willie Mullins favourites or whatever your preferred system happens to be. That's not my preferred system, just to be clear. Yeah, it's traumatizing even to think about it. And it just, a bit like the whip issue, it feels like we're stumbling over blocks that should not be there. It's long past due for the government to introduce some clarity into this discussion. And that has got to be the focus.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's quite significant this week as well that it has been discussed. 600 people were at the racing conference from over 40 countries. So the issue it was raised by sort of Hong Kong executives, so that's how much of a big issue it is, not just from our little bubble in British racing, but from a sort of global perspective now. It's been given. Catherine, we talked about the Cheltenham Festival. You know, how significant is it going to be? We talked about how the whip would be a big story. For many punters, this is surely going to be something that really impacts their own experience. And if you are suddenly saving up for it and suddenly you're told you can't get a bet, I mean, some people are going to walk away, aren't they? They're not going to be interested by Gold Cup Day.
Yeah, absolutely. I've really got the sense that we are snowballing here. And by the time we get to March, we have no idea what this issue is going to be, the extent of this issue. We're either going to turn off punters that maybe casually bet and want to bet a little bit more during the festival, or we're going to turn them to black market sites. If they're more serious punters, perhaps. I know from the Racecourse Media Group survey that 50% of respondents refuse to supply personal information when asked, and this is going to play in when more people bet during the festival. And that, I'm just pulling out all the figures for you, 92% of over 3,000 people asked said they'd consider using different bookmakers if that personal information wasn't required. Now, if it's been asked across all our regulated bookmakers, where are they going to turn? That is the question, and that's going to severely impact the money that comes into the sport.
Yeah, and of course the Cheltenham Festival is just so massive on British racing's turnover. I mean, the majority of the top 50 races are, in fact, for betting turnover are during the Cheltenham Festival. I think all of the races on Gold Cup Day feature in the top 50 races. You know, it's crazy to think races like the Martin Pipe will get just as much sort of turnover as some of those classic races, you know.
Or the Albert Bartlett, I mean, okay, it's a grade one, but that's a 3-mile novice hurdle. And I mean, I would certainly think of that as an unattractive betting proposition. But as you say,
we'll ask you on Gold Cup Day.
Well, I mean, you can ask me when you like. I don't think I'll be having a bet on that, but lots of people will. And it's always up there in the top 30 races for betting turnover each year. And racing kind of needs that to continue to be the case. You know, these are not just races that produce income for the sport, but they generate interest, and they are like the glue that helps our audience stay attracted, you know, from one year to the next. We need that to be a success, that whole event. And we certainly don't need the Gambling Commission interceding to muck things up for everybody.
Yeah, okay, sure. Well, one thing we can be sure of as well is that this story is continue to roll on. Hopefully, in the next few weeks, we might know a little bit more. So. Right, so it's my decision now in the hot seat to decide what is our story of the week. I think we've had three compelling enough cases put forward. Chris, I'll start with you. I thought bringing in your book was a good move. That was a good plug. That was a nice move. And of course, Ocean being back is good. I think the affordability, I don't think we know too much more, so I don't think I can give it to myself. I'm going to be very lenient.
Oh, that's great.
I think Catherine has convinced me this week. She has taken the top honours. The whip is just such a big story, and the fact that it's opened so many doors in search of how racing should be presented. It's got racing talking again. Who knew the whip was such a good topic of conversation in racing?
So we've talked too much about affordability, but we haven't talked enough about the whip. Is that what you're saying?
Well, what can I say? No, it is an interesting, and I think it's important as well that we still learn how to get the younger audience in, because they are our future after all.
And I'm afraid the reality is that the whip is just about the only topic of conversation in racing just now, isn't it? There's no point thinking about anything else until we can solve that crisis.
That's all for this week's show. Thank you very much to our guests Chris Cook and Catherine McRae. That's a brilliant show. Before we go, do make sure to download the brand new Racing Post app, as you will see right now. Thank you very much for watching, so do make sure you join us again next week. Make sure you like, comment and subscribe so we can hear all your thoughts on today's issue. I've been James Stevens, and make sure to join in next week for another episode of The Front Page.